You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our fair will be a reenactment of Final Destination 3. Your move, Ohio. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and in lieu of hate mail, please leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Please make them as hateful as possible. If you didn't like my opening quip about the death at the Ohio State Fair, if you don't like many of the offensive things I'm going to say today, just say it in iTunes as long as you leave us 5 stars. Alternately, if you enjoy your trip here today, please tell a friend or leave us a support us on Patreon. I did things inverted this week, so my brain got confused. Support us on Patreon, patreon.com/themidside. That's per episode support. It's not a flat fee per month. So if we don't put out stuff, if we don't put out crap, you don't have to pay for it. Joining me this week, this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
And what a glorious day it is to be joining you here today at the Midside. I am just thankful every day for the opportunity to work with you, Justin M. Wisniewski.
Wow, where did that come from? Did I say my name wrong at the top of the show or something?
No, I just have to butter you up so I can tear you down later in the show when I rip into Dunkirk.
Oh, this is set up for the Dunkirk. Okay, well, you still think there aren't phallic symbols in Sucker Punch, so...
Yes, indeed. I'm not one of those people. I will never be a Freudian.
So, also joining us from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
Justin, I loved Dunkirk. I saw it twice in theaters, just for you.
All right. I mean, look, it's not like there's allegiance to me here in the Midside or not. I mean, go to What is the Midside
on
the Midside.
Wait, what?
Go to What is the Midside on themidside.com and you can read. It's all about you being you, and we're exposing the cultural forces that don't let you be you. So, I mean, you guys can disagree. You have every right to be idiots. I mean, that's fair, but
it's,
I'm just going to tell you. Right, it is. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And,
right.
You know, for
Article
a lot of
dumb fuck. Right. Also, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is not in the Constitution, but thanks for playing.
I love what I call people
East Coast
stupid.
School.
I love when I call people stupid and then I do something stupid. But
yeah, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was clearly written in the Democratic papers written by Karl Marx before the Constitution was published.
Right.
If only. But when we're talking about dumb people doing dumb things, we have to talk about fake news. And here's the thing. Everyone talks about fake news as if it's only in politics, but I think we really need to use the opportunity, the rhetorical situation, the cultural situation that Donald Trump has created to examine it in other ways. And specifically, the way I've been seeing this is in the news about the Justice League movie that has come out over the last few weeks. Now, we all remember the story where Zack Snyder had to step down from directing because his 20-year-old daughter committed suicide. It's a tragedy. It is a huge tragedy, and he had to stop. It was after the film had been shot. They had done an edit of the film, and he had brought in Whedon to write some new scenes, and he decided, you know, Whedon would be in charge of all the reshoots, which would be shooting these new scenes, and, you know, it's typical to shoot any scenes over again that there might have been mistakes or you weren't happy with. So he decided Whedon would take over from him. And when he stepped down, he said, "I know how this story is going to look and how it's going to be spun." Now, he didn't say that directly. He said, "I know how this story is going to look, but I'm doing this anyway because this is what I need to do for me." And not surprisingly, months afterwards, when there's enough distance from the tragedy, we're starting to see stories where this event is spun. And it's being spun as if the Justice League movie is a mess and it's totally awful and Whedon needs to come in and save it. First, The Hollywood Reporter had an article saying Ben Affleck was no longer going to be Batman because he's too old and he doesn't want to do it anymore. This is, of course, a subtle dig at Snyder's casting of Ben Affleck as an older Batman and casting Ben Affleck at all, which people had problems with from the beginning. Now, at Comic-Con, Ben Affleck came out and said, I have no problem being Batman. I'm going to continue to be Batman. I am honored being Batman. And in that article, there was a paragraph of opinion by the author calling the Justice League reshoots extensive. Everyone just ran with that and said, oh, well, they used this adjective in this article, therefore it's extensive. Now, I wanted to point something out. There weren't any quotes. There wasn't even any sources. It didn't even say sources say. They just characterized it as extensive. So it was the author, the writer's own language. It was their own choice. I think it was a woman who wrote it. I'm not sure, though. Then recently, even more recently, Variety followed that up with an entire article saying the reshoots are extensive. They're $25 million, and they're shooting over 20% of the picture over. But here's the thing. In that article, it did say sources, but it didn't give any quotes, and it didn't name the sources. And that's a common technique we've seen with fake news these days, is they say sources, but they never name them because they're quote-unquote protecting the anonymity. And at the end of the article, it had a quote from Ray Fisher, who plays Cyborg, saying, all of those rumors are crap. Not coincidentally, Ray Fisher at the Comic-Con panel wore a t-shirt that said I Heart ZS on it. I wonder if Ray Fisher understands what's going on in the media. Likewise, let me ask you just a logistical question. And this again goes to, if you remember, a few weeks ago we talked about the Ben Shapiro article about how to spot fake news. You touch against reality. If Justice League is to come out at end of November, I think it's November 19th, November 17th, something like that. If that's when it's to come out, and this is a special effects heavy movie, and we're now at the end of July, even if you start the reshoots in May or June, how do you reshoot 20% of a film like that 6 to 7 months before it comes out? Because don't forget, you have to edit it as well. There's color correction. There's just the editing process of piecing the footage together. There's composing. There's getting the approval of all the people who have to see it. How do you have the time? There's the technological rendering of the special effects. How do you have the time to shoot all of this? So the question you have to ask is, and if you're a new listener here in the Midside, I will leave this open for you to interpret on your own, or maybe Daniel and James can chime in here. But if you're an old listener, you know what I'm implying. If you're an old Midsider, you know what I'm implying. Why do you think it is that all of a sudden these rumors are starting up, especially around Comic-Con season? Do you think there's a reason? Or do you think that I'm the crazy one and that this is just a conspiracy theory I'm concocted?
Is that a rhetorical question? Or should you're a conspiracy theorist?
Really? I don't think stuff like this, it's not a conspiracy. You're just noticing a pattern. And you're not claiming it's a conspiracy. It's
correct.
A lot of times mass action based on particular ideas takes the form of the mass action having a kind of head, a director, you know, like the expansion of the state. It, you know, if you're an Alex Jones type, then you're going to notice these patterns and you're going to conclude that someone is responsible, someone or some group is singularly responsible for the continuous expansion of the state in our taking away of freedoms, you know, like the Build-A-Bear group or whatever. But it's not really the Build-A-Bear group. It's just mass action caused by ideas that are all similar. And I think that's what you're noticing here.
Correct. And I would say that it's a confluence of events with ideas. And also, I think Marvel is being very opportunistic in driving this to a certain extent because it kills their greatest competition, basically. Mm. So it's a confluence of events, which includes Marvel.
Yeah. I don't disagree with any of that. Just as there is soft despotism where there's no one person pulling the levers of the increase in government, there is also a sort of soft hatred of DC, which is, I don't think there's a single person pulling the lever necessarily, but there's sort of a cultural confluence of events and ideas. I'm just basically repeating what James said so I can sound smart.
Well, no, I want to be clear, though. I don't think it's just a soft cultural hatred of DC. I think it's a soft cultural hatred of Snyder. And I think part of what has driven the soft cultural hatred of DC is the pre-existing soft cultural hatred of Snyder. To a certain extent, DC kind of screwed itself by bringing Snyder on. And what I mean by that, just from a PR marketing perspective, I don't think they realized that at the time, but I do think that is what happened.
Yeah.
What I notice with this is that what people are doing is they point out there's like, what's funny is that a lot of the specific criticisms that people point out about Snyder's movies, I think are often real criticisms, but like you can see the motive behind it because they're not, even though these criticisms could be fully argued, they don't end up getting fully argued. They're just sort of like, oh, we all know Zack Snyder. It takes that form, and that's how you know there's a sort of, like, people repeat this and they don't really know why a lot of times is what.
Can you unpack the word criticism for the audience for a second? Because I don't want people to listen to this and say, oh, even on the mid-side, they say Snyder's a bad director. What do you mean by criticism?
I mean, they just point out things that at least I think are actual flaws of the movie. I know we're going to disagree on that point, but
all right,
I don't want
to
necessarily...
moving on to the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I'm not really interested in discussing those criticisms I would have of Snyder's work. The point is that... they reference those things. I think they use the fact that there are these errors to sort of get their meat hooks into an attack on romanticism in general. I think you're definitely on to something. 'Cause the same thing happens in anime, is what I notice, is that anime in general has these particular gaping flaws. A lot of them have to do with kind of the, I don't know, this is a little bit of a stretch, but I'm at least getting close to the mark. Anime has these flaws that result in the sort of almost like emotional autism of their, I think, the Japanese culture. I don't want to make a prejudgment there, but it seems something like that. But what they do is they use that as a sort of rationale to attack the idea of expressing emotions and values openly and passionately on screen. They're uncomfortable with that, and so they choose to mock it on its lowest level, you know, the sort of Asperger's-y expression of those emotions that anime often takes on.
Well, I don't know anything about anime, so I can't really comment on anything you just said about
but
anime.
But I mean, you're probably aware of how strange anime can be, right?
I mean, in the sense that I've watched it a couple times, and then most of the people who watch it are fucking weirdos, but now I just sound like a prick.
Yeah,
so.
Well, a lot of people who watch it are weirdos, and there's a reason for that. But a lot of times when anime gets attacked, it's not because of those shortcomings and those weirdnesses. Those shortcomings and weirdnesses are sort of used as a rationale to attack the good part of anime.
Daniel, do you have any comments on anime?
I have no comments on anime.
All right, so anime listeners out there, or anime watchers, I apologize for the use of the word listeners. Anime watchers out there, if you want to back up James or not, let us know. I literally don't watch anime, so I could have no comments on it. I can say, though, that this is going to be a fun episode, I think. Do you guys want to get into it?
I guess.
No. Oh, wait, yes.
It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
All was not well in Trumpland this week, as we got multiple stories generated by the White House, including, by the way, the addition of a character straight out of Jersey Shore named Anthony Scaramucci, otherwise known as The Mooch.
And, are people calling him that?
Shit up.
Are people... He is calling himself that.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is. So,
oh
there's
my
the
God,
mooch.
Is the Lincoln bedroom now the smush room?
Deputy Comms Director Snooki had this to say. Just kidding. This is going to be weird and fun, but mostly fun, but also terrifying and weird, but fun and terrifying.
But, what if he actually brought in the cast of Jersey Shore to be members of his team? Would that make things better or worse?
It would make it more entertaining.
The same.
but also worse, but also entertaining, but also worse. So the same. And the Mooch isn't even our lead story, by the way. I'm just using this as a sort of like, this couldn't have been the most, or this couldn't have been a more fucked up week for Donald Trump's administration if he had tried to fuck it up, which, who knows, maybe he is. But the point is, like, Mooch, like, in an article where apparently he didn't know he was on the record with a reporter, so either stupid or liar, as the comms director, said that he's no Steve Bannon, he's not trying to suck his own cock. He said that unlike in politics where people stab people in the back, he likes to stab people in the front. And somehow he thought that was better.
Because, I mean, this is a reality TV show. That is something you say. In fact, that was something that was said on reality television. So I've been watching a couple of episodes of The Challenge season 30 on MTV. This is where they bring back the people from the real world, the real rules, and Are You the One? And they have them compete in challenges and then vote each other out. And somebody said that. Tori from Are You the One said, you know, I'm a dirty player because it's season 30, Dirty 30. They brought up like the 30 dirtiest players. And Tori literally said that quote. Tori said that, you know, I'm dirty, but I won't stab you in the front. I won't stab you in the back. You'll see me coming. I'll stab you in the front. So they are literally now quoting reality television during Donald Trump's administration. We just need him to hire someone who comes out and said, I didn't come here to make friends.
That's right. That's right. And as a result of the Mooch not making friends, Reince Priebus is out as chief of staff and a new military guy is in because that's what you want is the soft-spoken military guy and the Jersey Shore comms director. That's basically the odd couple right there. It's going to be glorious. What else was glorious this week, at least from the Schadenfreude perspective, is Trump tweeting out a change in military policy which would allow transgender individuals to serve. This reverses an Obama administration order that did allow them to serve. So Trump, in fact, tweeted, after consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. He, of course, tweeted this without ever naming any of the generals or experts with whom he consulted. He continued, our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. And as one has come accustomed to expect with all things Trump-related, the media and the internet went fucking insane. And we are here to witness the farce. Justin, a few things. Let's start with tweeting a major policy change about the quote-unquote most powerful military in the world. Thoughts on that?
That's what I was going to ask you. Are tweets executive orders now?
This is actually a court case, by the way, of sorts, which is this whole travel ban thing, for instance. So, like, when Spicy was still in office... By the way, Spicy has also resigned, because he resigned because the Mooch came on board. So we lost Spicy, but we gained the Mooch.
He resigned, by the way, and on Nessun, on their Patriots feed, they had an article about it that says Spicer now has enough time to watch the Patriots as much as possible. That's how bad websites need clicks. They will find anything that is relevant to their content and post it.
That's right. So Spicy, though, in a press conference said that the president's tweets should be seen as orders. And then Trump's, I believe it's Solicitor General, is arguing in court that his travel ban is in fact not a travel ban, except that he tweeted out it is emphatically a travel ban. So the question is, who the fuck knows? But the point is, should this kind of stuff be tweeted out from the President of the United States? Is it time? Is it time, gentlemen, that the President used Twitter exclusively for his executive orders?
You know my feelings on this. I mean, I said this a few weeks ago when I talked about how I think only the POTUS office should have a Twitter. And that there, no, not even that, the POTUS office. It was, I said, the director of the White House press secretary, right?
Yeah.
The White House and the press secretary should run it. Correct. That's what I said. Please be consistent with yourself, Justin. Yeah, that's 100% what I think. And no, I do not think he should be making policy decrees on Twitter. I mean, this is just like, I don't like to make these comparisons, but can you imagine if Hitler had Twitter and used it as executive orders?
Yeah. Look out. Look who's coming for dinner, Poland.
Like the first, right. The first tweet he puts out is, "We must kill all these Jews." Like, like, no, I mean, here's the thing. He should be focused on governing. This is
Hitler
a general.
Or Trump?
Both of them. No,
just
Trump.
Be clear. Okay.
Yeah, no, we're talking about Trump. We're not talking about Hitler. I only reductio ad Hitlerum to show how absurd it is. Here's the general rule I have about social media, and this certainly applies to myself. So if you people see me during the week and you see me on social media, your conclusion is correct. I'm making that implication. If you are on social media that much, you are disconnected from reality because you do not have enough to do to be productive, or you have something that you're doing for a reason to be lazy to not be productive. You're avoiding something, or like I just said, you're being lazy. And that's the thing. I do not want the president of the United States on social media that much. He should be focused on learning, interacting. I mean, there are people who work just by going around and talking to people and having that information and then going talking to somebody else and just sharing information around. At the very least, that's what the president of the United States should be doing. But is he reading policy documents? No. Is he interacting with foreign leaders, foreign ambassadors? No. He's fucking on Twitter tweeting things. No, that's why you hire someone, so you don't have to spend the time with these distractions. I mean, we are literally weeks away from Trump having a daily meme feed of the best memes he's seen on the internet in the past 24 hours.
That's right. President content curator. It's a frightening thought. I doubt the man has read a Highlights magazine in a dentist's office. Actually, he's maybe done the little draw the line down a slide maze. He may have done that in the Highlights magazine, but read it.
Because here's the other thing about this with what you're saying with the Highlights magazine and everything. When you put the magazine in the doctor's office and the dentist's office, isn't that the time it's the most read?
It's true. It's true. You should have to. If I was a magazine publisher, I would make a dentist's office get multiple subscriptions.
Right. Mm-hmm. And usually that's what happens.
Leaving
is it goes
money
through
on the table.
It was a pun
literally
intended. Yeah.
On the table.
Yeah.
So
but here's
the other element of
this. This is
nope.
The reason I'm.
Are we still talking about Highlights? Because we got to move on.
No, it's not we're talking about Highlights. I'm using that as a metaphor.
Excellent.
The metaphor I'm making is this whole, and I think this will lead into what you're about to say, this whole transgender thing. If it had literally just been tweeted out by the White House press secretary or he said it in a conference, 99% of the people who responded to it would not have even been aware of it. But because it's on Twitter, you get all these fucking people who have nothing better to do commenting on it and acting like it's a big deal. And I do believe this is part of Trump's agenda to raise up this false opposition that doesn't really exist. But that's the thing, is like, if this was done through actual productive, rational channels, we wouldn't have 99% of the controversies we do.
And we also wouldn't have Trump. So, the question then is this a big deal? Should transgender individuals be allowed to serve in the military? James, I turn to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely a military question, and the answer is probably no. Because I mean, we disqualify people from the military for far less than this. You know, if your eyeballs are a little different than a normal person's eyeballs, you can't be a pilot. So it only makes sense that, you know, if you have a particular condition that's highly correlated with mental illness, and you may even say that, you know, this condition is a mental illness, then clearly that could disqualify you. It's just, the thing is that this is a politicized issue simply because we're trying to, you know, we're having this discussion about transgender quote unquote rights. And it has nothing to do with rights. It's just, do we accept transgenderism as being normal? And I don't think the answer to that is ever going to be yes in a logical world. Like, you can talk all day about how they have rights. They have the right to do to their body whatever they want. It's their body. But they're by no stretch of the imagination are they ever going to be normal. But because there's this push, we now politicize everything about it, including, and then the military ends up, you know, being the testing ground for this crap. So it's just silly. Like, it's the same thing as with women in the military and women on submarines. It's like, we can't have a rational conversation about it because of the way the left advocates for its positions.
That's true. We can't have a rational conversation about it, that's for sure. I'll push back a tiny bit and see what you think of this, which is, I mostly agree with you. I would say that it's a little more individualized, and it depends sort of like where we draw the line on what we mean by transgender. So,
yeah, sure.
Like, it's the same argument to me of like, should we have women firefighters? And my answer is, can they lift the same amount as male firefighters, climb the ladder in the same speed, and hold the hose for as long as male firefighters? No sexual innuendo intended. If the answer is yes, then yes, we can have female firefighters. I don't give a shit. But if they can't do those things, if we have to lower the standards for them in order so that we can have more women firefighters, I'm totally against that. Totally. So what do you think about that? If a transgender individual went through all the rigmarole tests and everything, they passed with flying colors, should they be allowed, even if they're openly, admittedly transgender?
Well, I think the issue with that is what James just said, is the classification of it as a mental illness or not. And if it's you're saying it's a mental illness, you're a priori, if someone walks in and says, I'm transgender, you're not even letting them go through the tests.
It's, well, even if you don't consider it a mental illness, it's highly correlated with mental illnesses that are already on the books, like schizophrenia. So that may be enough on its own. The thing is the military has its own way of doing things, and I think anyone who doesn't have military experience who starts shooting their mouth off about, you know, what the military should and shouldn't do is it's just ridiculous. Like, we're politicizing a very specialized issue. Imagine if we politicized, I don't know, like, you know, the selection of welders, like, you know, let's say the you know, welding required like a very hyper detailed eyesight or something and very steady hands, and now we start asking like, oh, should we have more women welders? Like, if I was a guy who hired welders for a company, I would just be like, wait, why are we talking? Why are we politicizing this issue? Like, this is a specialized issue that I'm an expert at. And like, I interview these people, I test these people. Like, there's all these specific details that go into it. And now we're supposed to throw in this political issue. It has no place in this selection process. And so I don't even really want to comment or take a stand on it, because it just makes my comment or opinion just a big joke, because there's so many actual professional considerations that go into these decisions that have nothing to do with politics.
But I get what you're saying, but to back up Daniel, and tell me, Daniel, if I'm speaking for you, maybe I'm incorrect here, but I think the issue is, right, first of all, let's just put this out. Transgender is such a small segment of the population. So we're really arguing about something that's negligible at this point. Although I would argue this is all part of Trump's plan. Hey, there's chaos in his administration. Okay, numbers.
Dude. I have numbers. So first of all, it's difficult to determine how many transgender are in the military because, again, whatever study that they do, it's how they define transgender.
Right, and so, that's the point I want to get to, too.
So there's a UCLA study from 2014 that estimated that there were 15,500 transgender service members. And that would be out of 1.28 million active members, so just over 1%.
That's high. That's more than I expected.
Yeah, so a Department of Defense study commissioned by the Rand Corporation, commissioned the Rand Corporation in 2016, and they said on the high end that they considered 6,600 transgender people actively in the military, but as low as 1,300. Again, depending on how you define transgender, and that would be on the high end under 0.5%. on the low end, way, way lower. So, but right, then, by the way, the UCLA study goes on to say that 21% of all transgender adults in the U.S. are serving in the military. That seems fucking absurd to me. But.
Well, if that doesn't argue mental illness, I don't know what does. It seems like they have a death wish. But I'm being glib. I'm being glib. Nobody out there get mad. Although, if you do get mad, iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. No, yes. I mean, and I think the key thing here, Daniel, is what you're saying is what the definition of transgender is. Because, and we've seen this now, we see this on reality television, we see this on the internet. When something becomes a hot button issue, especially in our culture, which is many times just racing to see who can claim the biggest victimhood status, a lot of people are calling themselves transgender who probably aren't legitimately transgender. So if somebody shows up to a military recruitment office, and again, I don't know how they handle this. I'm not telling them how to handle this. I'm just saying this is a question I have. And somebody says they're transgender. Do you a priori go, oh, you say you're transgender, therefore we're kicking you out? We're not even giving you a chance? How do you handle that? Because just because they say they are doesn't mean they are.
That was one of the implications of this I thought of, which is actually, like draft dodging if we ever had to, where it was like just walking in and be like, no, I'm transgender. It's like, oh, okay, goodbye. Like that's right. Could actually create a problem, but.
Right. And this goes back to the point about why Trump or the president shouldn't be on fucking social media. You can't send out a 140 character tweet that captures everything that James is talking about, how this is a military decision and they have to define certain criteria and have certain tests. He's oversimplifying everything. This is a complicated thing.
Yes, it is. I agree with everything you've both said. The last thing I'll say about it, though, to play somewhat of a devil's advocate, is that talking about politicizing the issue, one could very easily make the argument that Trump is politicizing the issue to appeal to some conservative base of his, and that this isn't a military decision, because we don't know. He didn't name which generals. No generals came out and said, yeah, by the way, we agree with Trump.
Yeah, in that's fact, the fake news principle didn't. We used, right?
Yes. So if you don't name sources. It depends on who you're thinking is politicizing the issue.
Oh, I think Trump is politicizing it too. We said this during the election, that Trump and Hillary were guilty of the same things, which I think we'll get to in a second here.
Guilty and Clinton in the same sentence.
Gave you that transition there. But yeah, no, I think Trump's certainly politicizing it. And not only that, I do think it was a smokescreen. Not coincidentally, his administration's in chaos this week and people are getting fired and the mooch is talking about sucking his own dick. Like, is that not transgender? Trying to suck your own dick? Like,
no, that's just called talented. Speaking of talent... Dick,
what?
Never mind. What? Hillary Clinton is letting her guard down in a new memoir about her stunning election defeat. That's right. For the first time since her presidential run and her defeat to Donald J. Trump, Hillary Clinton is revealing personal details of the unprecedented campaign through her tell-all book named What Happened? Not question mark. Although... Yes. What a fucking title. Oh, it is What Happened, period, though. It's not What Happened, question mark. Like, it's not that she's admitting she's senile. I'm like, what's going on? Did I run for something? Although that would be hilarious. Publisher Simon & Schuster says the memoir will be out September 12th, and it details Clinton's experience of becoming the first woman nominated for president by a major party during a historic election, quote, marked by rage, sexism, exhilarating highs and infuriating lows, stranger than fiction twists, Russian interference, and an opponent who broke all the rules. Finally, in an introduction to the novel, Clinton writes, quote, in the past, for reasons I try to explain, I've often felt I had to be careful in public, like I was on a wire without a net. Now I'm letting my guard down. She addresses the challenges of being a strong woman in the public eye, the criticism over her voice, age, and appearance, and the double standard confronting women in politics, because we know Donald Trump was never criticized for his voice, age, or appearance during the election.
Or gender, sorry, just to be clear. I mean, they went or after gender too.
Added that little point there at the end that was not part of the quote. Just wanted to be very clear how fucking retarded that was. Justin, how fucking retarded is this?
There are just so many things to say about this. It just culturally, this is just like a cesspool of like almost everything that's wrong with our culture. So the basic point I want to build to is like at what point are you unethical by going forward with things? So, and I see this as two ways. The people who are letting Hillary Clinton just continue down this downward spiral, like, this is literally like a relapse, right? This is like somebody is an alcoholic. They have like an alcoholic, like, meltdown. This is election night for Hillary Clinton. And then you just continue to let her drink alcohol later on. That is what's going on. Like,
I like the analogy, but it's even worse. I'm going to make your analogy even worse, which is that even if Hillary Clinton had said, I think I may be an alcoholic, the rest of the people around her are going, no, you're not. Drink more.
That's what I'm saying.
It's like reverse intervention.
Right. That's 100%. You nailed exactly what I'm trying
power
to say.
And influence.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And that's what I'm asking about with ethics. Because, like, at a certain point, isn't it ethical if your friend is so disconnected from reality that you're like, maybe you need to, like, take a step back and, like, figure out what's going on and, like, heal your life? But then, exactly, on the other hand, it's the same thing with Hillary. To a certain extent, this is one of those where the way you act just becomes the way you live. She is clearly just pandering to make a buck at this point, right? Selling this book is just pandering to her base and making a buck. And isn't that the society we live in right now? So something I talked about with Linkin Park, and I've been saying about Linkin Park since Chester Bennington's death, is I never realized how much of a big deal they were, but it's really because they were right before the internet really took over. They were one of the last, like, mainstream crossover bands, because everything now is just these subcultures on the internet, and then you just find your subculture and you just keep selling them crap. You just keep repurposing it and selling it to them. And, I mean, it's even merchandise you do that with. You take your logo and put it on a bunch of shirts, or, you know, you take different quotes and put them on shirts, or beer koozie, or sunglasses, or Daniel,
or
you sound
hats.
Like you have something to say, or pussy hats, right? Mm-hmm. Or Make America Great Again hats. And you could argue this was Trump's entire strategy. You could say he's the internet subculture president. But at what point is that unethical as well? Because how many of these subcultures, and I see this all the time, and actually this is a problem I have with Funko subculture, and believe me, Funko Pops, I wonder, because it's really hard not to falsely induce and saying, am I the same as them and I have the same errors? But how many of these subcultures are people who have psychological issues and they're looking for something to latch onto, and people like Hillary Clinton are taking advantage of these people with issues by just taking their money, by saying, you know, buy this book and it will momentarily make you feel better, and in exchange you will give me money. It all seems super unethical to me. It seems, and that's my question. Maybe I'm being idealistic, because, you know, it's a free world. I believe in freedom, and I believe, you know, sell what you want to sell. But at what point can you no longer get up and look at yourself in the mirror? Because I like, if I don't do my gym routine, right? If I take a day off from the gym where I'm not supposed to, or if I eat like too much crap, I have a hard time looking at myself in the mirror the next day. I look at myself and I go, dude, you fucked yourself yesterday. You did not do well.
Yeah, but to be fair, Hillary Clinton hasn't seen her reflection in the mirror since that 1760 trip to Transylvania.
Right. No, exactly. 100%. And these are the questions I'm raising. And this is what I see when I see this. I see what happened. And it's like, I'm feeding you a false reality to make all of ourselves feel better. And I'm preying upon you in order to steal your money. That's basically what I'm seeing.
I didn't analyze this on that level. I think that's right, though. I didn't get past the idea that she's really opening up and showing us her emotions. You know, the thing she's never done in public ever to any extent whatsoever. But when she does open up her emotions, it's just more like political hackery, basically. Like, she's just, I mean, which it's not surprising. I think this is completely genuine. I think she is just political hackery all the way down. I don't think she has this Frank Underwood sort of, like, awareness of the fact that she's telling lies. Like, I think it's pretty clear at this point that she just believes her own bullcrap.
Yes, her reality is the fake reality that she's created for herself. It is detachment, but it is so far gone that I'm sure it's attached to something else. Like it's the leech attached to the ass of anti-reality, basically. I was curious if we had any guesses at what the chapters in her book would be titled. Her book, What Happened, i.e. chapter one, I never campaigned in Wisconsin, Michigan, or Ohio.
Oh, I thought there was going to be a chapter called It's All Bill's Fault.
Chapter one, when Bill raped that chick.
Right, exactly.
Yes. Any other? I don't know. I was curious.
I am not a robot. Chapter four.
Chapter two. Seriously, I'm terrible. That's all I got.
What about chapter that time, five?
What about that time she passed out on the super hot 76 degree day at the 9/11 memorial? I think that probably had something to do with her not winning.
I love how we're taking completely opposite approaches to these chapters. You're saying all the actual things that happened, and I'm saying all the things she's blaming it on.
I'm just curious if she was being honest. But yeah, anyway, speaking of brain damage, the NFL found that 99% of brains, or no, not the NFL, some, what was this? JAMA. Some journal found that 99% of deceased NFL players had CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, as a result of continuous hits to the head. These were all players whose brains were donated to science in order to study this unknown, this little known disease, I guess, and its relationship to football. Basically, Dr. Ann McKee, director of the Boston University CTE Center and co-author of the study, said, quote, "There's no question that there's a problem in football, that people who played football are at risk for this disease, and we urgently need to find answers for not just football players, but veterans and other individuals exposed to head trauma. And there is a helicopter flying around my apartment. Not sure if you can hear that on the podcast, but it has literally flown around three fucking times. So maybe the NSA has finally found me. Took you long enough." Okay, so
Patreon canceled.
So it's an interesting, and this study made the news everywhere because it was 99% of these deceased NFL players had CTE. And one of the interesting things that very few people are pointing out, and I'm wondering what James thinks of this, but I guess first I technically have to go to Justin because it's his show.
Yeah.
These were all brains that were donated because the families thought that the player had CTE. So what is that? I mean, not, I'm not saying that there isn't a connection or that we should necessarily downplay this study, but don't we have to take that into consideration when we're talking about this thing and the dangers of football?
100%. I think exactly what you're pointing out is there's errors in the methodology of the study, and then there's errors in the interpretation of the study. Another big one for me is just fucking look at reality. So let us grant the premise that 99% of football players have CT. Let's just grant that premise for a second. Are 99% of players living completely debilitated lives afterwards? I mean, Troy Aikman's commentary on games notwithstanding, there are a lot of them who are doing pretty well, especially pretty they're sure on television.
Pretty sure he does have brain damage.
That was the joke I was making.
It's hilarious. Yeah.
But no,
did Hillary Clinton play football? Oh, sorry.
I think something that needs to be taken away from this is, like, Justin, is that even if you have CTE, you may not be showing symptoms.
But that's the point I'm making.
That's a separate issue.
But that's the point I'm making, right? We all have things that are debilitating it throughout our lifestyle. Like, we don't, none of us get out of life unharmed, right? Like, my knee hurts. Like, I'm dealing with a shoulder injury right now, and like, my shoulder won't ever be like 100% ever again, because once you hurt something, especially you, as you get older, it gets harder to recover. But at what point is it something that is so damaging to your life that we say that this is, we need to stop football altogether because everyone that plays? Or what is it, what, at what point is it just the reasonable trade-off of life? So maybe you have CTE, but just because you have CTE, like you said, doesn't mean you're showing symptoms and doesn't mean it affects everyone the same way. I mean, I bet if you looked at every football player's knees, you'd say all of their knees have damage to them. But do we walk around and say, oh, well, nobody, we shouldn't have football anymore because their knees don't work? Now, I understand the brain's more important than the knee, but the point I'm making is we're not interpreting it correctly. If 99% of players have it and 99% of the players who have it are not leading worse lives, then maybe we need to see at what point CTE is bad. and is an issue, and why is it affecting Junior Seau to the point that he kills himself, but fucking Joe Montana is fine. You tell me Joe Montana didn't take a bunch of fucking hits in the day when we could actually hit quarterbacks?
Are you saying it's a white person thing?
Yes, that's exactly where I was going. You read my mind. Send hate mail to iTunes/welcome to the midside 5-star reviews.
Yeah, so I have mixed feelings about this in a certain sense, which is I certainly think that no matter what profession you go into, there should be some transparency about the, what the risks are in that given profession. And I think that the NFL in previous years has acted unethically by suppressing a lot of the research in these areas. But at the same time, like, the number one response I saw on social media to this article was, it's time to ban this barbaric game.
Right. Gods.
And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, first of all, if people understand a risk and they choose to take it, what the fuck do I care? But then two, exactly what Justin was saying, which is, it may be that 99% of these people had CT, but that doesn't give us all that much information about the quality of their life and what CTE means for them. Some experienced it worse than others, and the vast majority don't experience any symptoms at all. So what does that mean in reality? So that's the question we need to be asking, and then also just basically understanding this so we know how to treat it if there are symptoms. But to have this immediately go to, we have to ban this barbaric endeavor, to me just reeks of virtue signaling.
Now, James, I'm going to give you a setup here and push you in a direction. So I want to see what you do with this.
Run the correct route, though.
So you're probably going to set me up at somewhere I was going to go anyway, so right. Go ahead.
I want to draw the comparison to global warming and climate change. Mm. Isn't it just we keep getting things that are coming out against this and refuting this? Like, after the Will Smith stupid movie was released, like, everyone's like, oh, maybe this isn't as a big deal as people are making it out to be. And now all of a sudden they find a number that's 99%, and now they can market it more and make it seem like a bigger deal. Like, to me, this is the equivalent of Al Gore going, the 9/11 memorial is going to be underwater, and then in his new trailer, it's in there. So they just find these things that are rhetorically appealing but don't have any depth behind it, and then it becomes part of the common culture and accepted through just repetition.
Yeah, the thing is unlike global warming, this has, you know, this has a lot of very specific evidence for it as a harm. But I think makes the fact that statism and control is such a huge part of our cultural narrative that gets thrown out there is you can't talk about these things in a rational way, because a lot of people sort of attack this with a hidden agenda of like, okay, well, let's ban something or let's take some sort of collective action in order to solve this problem. It's like, this isn't a collective action issue. This is an issue of individual men weighing the risks. And to this article, I think this article does a good job because I never thought I'd see this, is a science article that actually explains the way that a study may be limited in its in the conclusions one could draw from it. And then at the end, they talk about, who's this guy? Kutcher, he talks about, you know, individual men have to make their own decisions about, you know, the risk factors. And he says football's a really big deal to these guys. And so, you know, and it fulfills a need for them. And so they, you know, they may still want to take the risk despite the possibility of this brain damage. And that's the only factor involved. It's only because of statism as a cultural force that this becomes a political issue. Why people are testifying in front of Congress is because Congress wants the ability. It's like, okay, well, where can we get our meat hooks into, you know, football also? And it's the same with global. Yeah, it is the same with global warming, because they turn a science with global warming. It's a scientific issue that could plausibly be construed in a way to expand the power of the government. And I think virtue signaling has a lot to do with it also, because you now get this easy way to signal moral virtue by saying, oh, well, we should ban it. Because that makes you feel as though you're taking a stand on some kind of issue. But it's the easiest stand in the world to take. Like, oh, well, we shouldn't do it.
Well, right. And to take this back to the top of the show where we're talking about it's not conspiracies, there are larger cultural forces at work here. Yeah. I mean, that virtue signaling is equivalent to just talking shit about DC and Snyder. That's how it becomes.
Yeah, there's a similar drive there. And another thing that I find offensive, and this spills into the next story too, is that physical activity is a real need for a lot of men, and especially boys.
Guilty.
And yeah, like, and so, you know, I constantly feel this kind of attack against, like, especially my own lifestyle. I can only really speak to my own feelings on this, is I feel an attack against my sort of physical lifestyle choices, where it's like, oh, you know, what I play airsoft, which is, it's basically like paintball, only the guns look like real guns. I do that, and I get the sense of like, oh, well, that's dangerous, or like, oh, well, you know, you're hurting your knee doing that. Like, yeah, I know. Like, I know I'm hurting my knee doing it, but that's worth it to me. What am I supposed to do? Sit around all day? Like, I'm not going to play the sport I want. Like, we have needs as males, and I feel like those needs really get trivialized. And
Sorry, James, finish your sentiment.
Yeah, that's all I was going to say. They get trivialized, but it's like, you know, even a domestic cat has to hunt. You know, even a rational animal still has to be an animal.
I hate when my manhood gets trivialized.
That's right. In one of the most astute observations The Onion has ever made, they did an article recently called, and this is the title, quote, "This here is probably our best-selling love seat," says man who would have been powerful, revered warrior 4,000 years ago.
Yeah. And I would just like to point out that at the end of James's...
Fucking astute. Sorry.
Yeah, it's extremely astute, and it leads perfectly into our next article, so I would just like to make one conclusion comment here, and then you can have your beautiful transition. That I would just like to point out that at the end of James's whole point, he arrived back at my original point, which was, yeah, I know it hurts my fucking knee, but I'm deciding to do that because it's worth the trade-off for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised how much you can actually still play a game even with sort of fucked up body parts. Like, my knee is fucked up and I essentially cannot run anymore, but I can actually airsoft fine still.
I mean, get an MRI, but yeah.
No, I already did. My knee's fucked. Okay. But, like, I need stem cells. But I don't need them now, and so in the meantime, I just don't run. But you
Gene
can still
Hackman.
Play the sport without running, believe it or not.
You need to go Christopher Reeve and just inhale the neck of a fetus.
That was basically the reference, yeah, I was making when I said Gene Hackman.
That's right. Speaking of brain damage, Princeton has...
Can that just be our transition every story from now on?
Yes, this week there is a theme going on. But Princeton has a new men's engagement manager to combat aggressive masculinity on campus. That's right. Are young men at Princeton University violent, aggressive, hyper-masculine, stalkers, or rapists? A new position at the Ivy League institution indicates campus officials apparently think enough of its male students grapple with such problems that it warrants hiring a certified clinician dedicated to combating them. The university is in the process of hiring a, quote, interpersonal violence clinician and men's engagement manager, who will work with the campus office called SHARE, that's dedicated to survivors of sexual harassment, assault, dating violence, and stalking. According to SHARE, 1 in 4 female undergrads experienced such misconduct during the 2015-16 school year. The men's manager will also launch initiatives to challenge gender stereotypes and expand the school's, are you ready for this? Men's allied voices for a respectful and inclusive community. Which, if you weren't paying close enough attention, spells Maverick. A self-described violence prevention program at Princeton that often bemoans toxic masculinity on its Facebook page. Justin, you got your resume ready?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm the perfect candidate to fucking destroy this goddamn fucking program. A couple things first before I just rant on this absolutely dreadful bullshit. Is Gary Busey in charge of all marketing nowadays? It seems like everything is a backronym.
That's an also an astute observation on your part, so well done there.
And second of all, do we just, like, is everything the 1 in 4 statistic now? Where it's like, this has something to do with sexual assault. Like, just say it's 1 in 4.
Or
like,
1 in 5. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the statistic that's been debunked just simply by reality over and over again. Right?
Yes. I want to bring up the Adam Carolla point here tangentially, which is if parents right. honestly believe that there's a 20 to 25% chance that your child will be sexually assaulted at a campus and you allow them to go there, you're a fucking horrible parent or you're a goddamn liar.
Right, and so that was the implication it? I was making by reality refuting it. You know, it's the whole idea that, and this actually leads into exactly what I was going to say, with this idea of, like, the stalking and the violence and everything. Like, if you really believe you are this much of, you know, in this much danger all the time, carry a fucking gun. I don't even care if you don't have a gun license. I don't care if it's not legal to carry on campus. If you believe that you are in this much danger of being stalked, in this much danger of being attacked, then you would act on it in reality. Unless you're that fucking brain damaged. So yeah, speaking of brain damage.
Are you saying that this is how we get leftists to promote Second Amendment rights?
Well, I mean, that's another contradiction they hold. If you really believe masculinity is that much of a danger and it's that violent, why would you then also be advocating no guns? It doesn't make any fucking sense. But I mean, that's a whole other point. But it really gets to what I'm getting at. This is the issue I've had. I've had this issue since undergrad. And this even started with the word creepy. And I'm talking about in, like, you know, this is like 2001 to 2005 when I was an undergrad at Ithaca College, where all of this becomes simply based upon the woman's definition. And what I mean by that is if a man is interested in a woman and she finds him unattractive and he, you know, asks her out or he pursues her or he gives her a gift, back then she would label him creepy. Now we have terms like fuckboy, where, oh, you know, I'm just going to say all he wants from me is sex. And here's the thing. What we're doing is we're delegitimizing and we're devaluing the actual dangers that exist. Some people are creepy. There are fuckboys out there. There are stalkers out there. There are domestic abusers out there. There are people who commit sexual assault out there. But when you're throwing these terms around because you're saying it's only based upon each individual woman's definition of what they are, you're making society more dangerous. And you're actually making the problem worse. Because people who are simply trying to express themselves and saying what they want, and they're trying to figure out how to do it in a healthy way, and they genuinely are going about it benevolently, you're demonizing it. You're creating a position on campus to tell these men they're evil. Why don't you create one that says, like, look, you honestly, this is going to sound incredibly fucked up, but you would be better off creating an office of the pickup artist and putting Mystery in charge of men on your campus than you would be with this bullshit. Mystery is the pickup artist from the book The Game by Neil Strauss. Because, you know, as many problems as I saw with the rationalism that pickup artists had, where they're just creating systems and they're not actually trying to fucking, I don't know, get to know women, as they were trying to help men figure out how to talk to women and how to have sex and how to achieve their values. Even if they were going about it in a fucked up way, that at least they were trying to be positive. Instead, what are we doing? We're just telling men how evil they are.
To appropriate another Adam Carolla sentiment, which he uses in regards to racism, I will say that basically there's never been a better time in history to be an actual rapist.
Yeah.
Because you get lumped in with people who stare awkwardly and make you feel uncomfortable, which is defined at the University of Michigan as a form of rape, for instance. So
stare rape.
Wait, feeling uncomfortable is a form of rape?
If someone stares at you and it makes you uncomfortable, that is in the category of rape.
It's like light rape.
Look, this was an article I read undergrad. This woman goes into this prison to take a tour of it. This man's prison, this male prison, right? So, Hey, how often do men in an all men's prison see women?
Pretty infrequently, I suppose.
Right, and how many of them are gay and how many of them are straight?
I suppose the majority are straight, although maybe they're sucking a little dick here and there.
Right.
But
well, I mean, they might be, because otherwise they're not getting their dick sucked either, right? This is why we see this in prison. But the point is, this woman walks in and takes a tour, and then she's like, all of these men are staring at me and they're sexualizing me and they're seeing me as just a body. And then the conclusion of the article was, the male gaze steals my identity. If you objectify me, you are stealing my identity.
G-A-Z-E, right? Okay. Yeah, this is all insane. James, do you have anything to add to this insanity?
It's just more attack on masculinity as such. Something that's worth noting about this article, the details of it, they don't talk about what specifically they're going to do to combat toxic masculinity. I think there are ways that men often express themselves in a quote-unquote masculine way that is harmful, but that's one of those package deals. It's not the masculinity that caused them to act harmfully. It's usually a lack of self-esteem, and so they assert their masculinity in these harmful ways, but it has nothing to do with masculinity as such. It's similar to how, you know, if there's a bank robber, it's like, sure, he was doing it. He was robbing the bank because he thought it was in his self-interest. But selfishness has nothing to do. It's not the selfishness that caused him to rob the bank. It's his lack of respect for other people that caused him to do that. So similarly, they're trying to make masculine, the word masculine, like selfish. They're trying to say, okay, that's the main root of the problem, and so that's what we have to specifically combat in order to solve these behavioral issues. And James, also, just the whole idea of solving individual problems of behavior with some kind of mass action is the root of so many of our problems. Like, oh, we really need to do something about the fact that, you know, fill in the blank, people can't save money. Like, the worst thing you can do to improve individual behavior is have some kind of mass action to achieve it.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, James, and to sort of back up what you're saying or go into it a little bit more, you know, we talk about the mid-side. It's about not being either side of these sort of false dichotomies, where one of them I've always experienced in my life is like the different types of males, right? We have the stereotypical alpha and we have the stereotypical beta, you know, the stereotypical alpha being like Don Draper, the stereotypical beta being sort of the Pajama Big Bang Boy. Theory. Oh, Gamma? Okay. What?
Pajama Boy. You remember Pajama Boy?
Yeah, Pajama Boy.
He's no, the guy sitting Pajama on his Boy. Bed drinking hot cocoa promoting Obamacare.
No, I don't know that one. So, yes,
oh,
we'll
Google
say that
it.
Guy.
You will be delighted.
Yeah, horrified. You're delighted. Yeah, either are. But the point is, I've never identified with either because both of them have major problems with the way I see them approaching the world and women. You know, I have a hard time with being around Pajama Boy and company because it's like they're so fucking defeated and wussy and they won't like assert themselves and say, this is what I want. But on the other hand, they do, the stereotypical alphas do overly see them as women as just physical. And they completely ignore the psychological. Like I was saying with the pickup artist community, they don't interact with them and try to learn about them and connect with them on that level that, you know, does make the physical better, right? Sex gets better if you're connected psychologically, emotionally. So that's what you're saying, James, is they're taking that negative part of the quote-unquote alpha, and there's, as you're saying, they're trying to package deal that into saying all masculine men are that way. And it's taken me a long time in my life to realize, no, I am very masculine in a way that is healthy and in a way that other men should be. I mean, when I'm called hyper-masculine, I had to take a step back, and I was like, really? I'm hyper-masculine? But we don't define it in a healthy way because we don't have these conversations. We just, as you're saying, James, we demonize by package dealing. And it's, I would like to deal my package, but not in that way.
Absolutely.
Any final thoughts, Daniel, on this?
No, I have no final thoughts on anything.
Okay. Well then, speaking of brain damage, we're about to get to your thoughts on Dunkirk. It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't.
wasn't focused on. All right, I'm being a little over the top. I'm being a little harsh, but Daniel saw Dunkirk and he actually wants to talk about the major critique I've seen of this movie. So, Daniel, I'm interested to hear your thoughts. I'm interested to hear, first of all, what you thought of the movie, if you enjoyed it, what you rated it, and then your critique. Yeah.
So, saw Dunkirk, went with a friend to see it in Baltimore, which was a theater, like one of only 30-something theaters in the country that were showing it in the full 70 millimeter IMAX film. So not digital, 70mm IMAX projection. So screen was 5 stories tall, and it was film projected. It was glorious.
Was Christopher Nolan there sitting in the back being like, excellent, exactly what I wanted?
He was in the back, but he was jerking off. But yeah, Dad did pay extra to watch him, and so I did. But the point is that the experience of the movie was out-fucking-standing. It was completely immersive. I could feel my heartbeat increasing when he wanted it to increase and sort of mellow out when he wanted it to mellow out. Like, the first scene, without giving away much, where they get an actual shelling on the beach and they have to, like, duck and, like, I thought I might have a heart attack in that moment. It was so intense. So I will say that as a theatrical experience, it was pretty incredible to be immersed like that in this 2 hours of just heart-wrenching intensity. But the guy I went with and I, after the movie ended, we felt similarly strange about the movie, which is we were talking and almost simultaneously we said, this movie didn't really have a plot. It was just sort of a series of events that happened, and it was almost like, quote, like captured on film. Obviously it wasn't. Sort of like a documentary that was a fictionalized documentary, which is a movement lately. There's a lot of that. The one I recently talked about on the show was The Crown on Netflix, which doesn't have a plot. It's just a series of events that happened and we're going to fictionalize them. I would say that, you know, I just reread Ayn Rand's definition of plot from the Romantic Manifesto.
I was just going to read that. So this is what it says. A plot is a purposeful progression of logically connected events leading to the resolution of a climax.
Yes. And so I would say that Dunkirk has a purposeful progression of logically connected events leading to, and then we're fucking done. Which is the point that I want to make about the plot.
Interesting, that's not where I thought you were going to go.
The point I want to make about the plot is that there isn't a resolution of a purposeful climax here. It's just 3 stories that have to be going on simultaneously, and they cross each other, and then they just sort of keep lightly going after that. But there's no actual resolution of a climax. There's no way in which the logical connection of these events leads to a purposeful resolution at all. It just sort of happens. And that's where I think I was lost, because I was in the film, I was sort of engrossed, but by the time I got to the end, I sort of thought, well, what was that? What did I just... There was no climax and resolution here. It's just sort of events happen simultaneously, and now the movie's
all right, I'm going to push back. I have major pushback on
this. I actually have pushback too now. I thought I was going to agree with you, Daniel, but I actually disagree now. But Justin first.
All right. So I think, James, I'll probably help your argument here. I thought you were going to go after the word purposeful with the progression. That's where I thought you were going to go with this. So the fact that you actually went to the resolution of a climax is interesting to me. And I think the answer to your critique is the quote at the end when they get there and the old guy's holding out the blankets and he's like thanking them. And he's like, thank you, thank you, thank you. And the guy looks at him and he said, all we did is survive. And the old guy says, that's enough. That's the resolution. That's the climax, is they survived. To me, the climax of the story was when all the boats showed up. That's when I felt the emotional release, and I was like, okay, we've achieved our goal. That's what we're working towards. And then everything after that is, what's the falling action from them surviving and getting off and how they get home and everything. So I definitely think there's a resolution of a climax, and it's when everything overlapped.
See, I didn't experience that at all as a climax of the plot. I experience it as an emotional climax, but there's other sort of the confluence of the 3 storylines isn't necessarily at that point anyway, I don't think. And that's part of why I didn't feel like there was a purposeful climax there. The purposeful progression is certainly there. I think each individual character in the story is trying to achieve a goal, and there's a progression that they go through to get there. I just don't think that the three main characters converge in a way that is logically connected and has a resolved climax.
How is it not logically connected? So spoilers here majorly. So if you haven't seen Dunkirk yet, just fucking pause the episode or fast forward. Hit the 15-second fast forward thing on the iPhone. And if you have an Android, I don't know what to fucking tell you.
30 seconds.
Is it 30 seconds on an Android?
Yeah, on Stitcher.
All right. So 30 seconds on Stitcher on Android, apparently. So thank you, James.
You might want to hit it like two or three times, actually.
But. Yeah. Just keep going until you hear me say the word balls, because that's what I'm going to say after I finish spoiling all this. So definitely Tom Hardy, without him, they couldn't have all survived, right? And then he comes in, he uses the plane to kill people who are stopped trying to kill them. And then the other plot with the boat and the civilians, without them, they couldn't have survived. And obviously they were the ones who made the micro decisions that get them to the point of being saved by the boat. And the main character getting saved. I mean, I knew at the end that they were going to, the main character was the last one the civilian boat was going to pull out of the water. You know, though I said that. It was just completely obvious to me that it was going to be him, the last person pulled out. The person I saw it with, my friend Brian, I looked at him, I said, yeah, he's going to, when they started pulling people out, I go, it's going to be the main character who they're going to pull out of the oil last. Like it was all about the survival, and that's how it, that was the confluence right there, was the survival and the pulling that guy out of the water. Balls.
Louder. We need it louder.
Balls!
There you go. So I could concede that Tom Hardy's character has an interconnection between all the stories, but the other two, and especially the main one, there's not necessarily a logical integration for me for what happens with him. Like, it's just sort of, he's pursuing a goal, he can't get it, and then he gets pulled out of the water. Like,
here's the problem I think you're having is, how do you do this film and not have it be naturalistic? And what I mean by that is, naturalism is when you privilege the forces of the world, whether it be reality, the culture, other people, over the efficacy of the main character, of the protagonist, of the individual. And when you have a story about survival, and where survival stacked against you, and ultimately you're saved, how do you make that not a naturalistic story? And that was the challenge Christopher Nolan was presented with this film. And it sounds to me like you're saying, and I don't think you're saying this maliciously, and I don't think you're saying it explicitly, but I think you're saying that Christopher Nolan did not meet that challenge. But the answer to that I would give you is, his point was, when you strip away, and this goes to Adam Carolla saying, we are in a society that is so successful that we create problems. When you strip away all of the first world problems, and you are left with the very basic problem of survival, life or death, and it's immediate survival, all you have is the decision right in front of you of the moment, in the moment. And I think that is one of the major points of the movie, especially with the plot of the soldiers, with that main character, who is the main character of the movie, where it's all about how he constantly is making these micro decisions. For instance, when they all get on the boat and they're all beneath decks and he stands near the door. By the way, if you ever want an example of hypervigilance in film besides Man of Steel, where Clark's overwhelmed as a child, look at this scene where he, you know, he is in such survival mode that he knows where the exit is, and somebody goes to him, why are you near the exit? It's because he knows that is the optimal way to survive. Now, things happen where, obviously, they get bombed. So, spoilers again, I guess. I'll say balls again in a second here. That's out of their control that they get bombed. And it's out of his control that the French guy on the deck is the one who opens the door and lets him out. But he did what he could. He used the amount of efficacy he had to maximize his chances of survival. And that is the romanticism, and that is the logical connection in the plot, is they're all individually doing the most they can with their efficacy to create the optimal outcome they all want and value, which is the survival of as many troops as possible. Balls!
I see the argument. I think the argument makes sense. I would say that the explanation of what was going on to me is a better... is a better execution than Nolan's, then, is what I would say.
I mean, if you want to say that I'm a better, like, storyteller than Christopher Nolan, like, we can be done here. Like,
I will
accept that outcome of your argument.
Because I'm not saying that the movie is naturalistic, but actually the phrase I used in the after I was seeing it with my friend was it seemed like postmodern romanticism, which is that it had the elements of romanticism without certain things being emphasized that I think need to be emphasized in order to be truly romanticism, which is, I guess, one of the things that would have made it more clear for me that the resolution was connected is if you had a concretization of the enemy, basically. Like, one of the interesting things for me at the end is I was like, oh, we've never seen a Nazi.
Yeah, even when they were shooting up the boat that they were all hiding in, you didn't see them. No, and I mean, now we're entering into the breach here, which is this Snyder-Nolan divide with romanticism. And I think that this postmodernism you just said is the major critique of Christopher Nolan. And he did it less in the Batman trilogy, which is why I think you look at The Dark Knight, which is how non-postmodern it is. I think that's, you know, why it's arguably his most successful film. But even in something like The Prestige, he relies heavily on postmodern narrative construction in order to create his movies. Now, I want to make a point. I love Christopher Nolan. I think he's great. But this is why I like Snyder more than him.
And I never thought about it before this movie because it was never as apparent as it was in this movie. But I think that might be why I also like Snyder more than I do Nolan.
You cannot. It is inarguable that the narrative construction of Dunkirk, which is part of what makes it so good, right? Because he doesn't try to play, it's not a documentary, he's not trying to be realistic. But you cannot argue that the different time lapse, the one day, the one week, the 1 hour, it's inarguable that is postmodern. That is a postmodern plotting device, narrative device.
In what way?
Because it's emphasizing the lack of structure over the structure.
Yeah, I think that's a very long conversation that we don't necessarily need to get into now.
I think that is a great way to foreshadow that Christopher Nolan is the next director we have selected for our series of dissecting his movies. We will be doing the Nolan notes, and we will be starting with his first movie, and we will be tracking this postmodernism in it. Because I will say this, I do think he does this postmodernism in the ideal way it can be done. I don't think postmodernism in itself is bad. I think it's used by hacks to create hacky art. And I think Nolan does it as best as possible. But I do think that, you know, it's worth discussing and tracking this throughout.
I want to bring up one last thing with Daniel about the issue of sense of life. I feel like, according to my classification scheme of sense of life, Nolan is what I call intelligible universe. Man is good. Man has free will. So all very positive in that respect, but also very negative. I see Nolan as a malevolent universe sense of life. So even though he's very positive in those other senses where man is good and man has choice, he still sees he still projects a view of existence as being hard and gritty. And that is really what I share that sense of life with Nolan personally. And I really loved the ending of those because this is spoilers, and I'll say balls at the end. They try so hard throughout the movie, and you know, the soldier on the beach does everything he can to escape. And then the boys, but yet when he does, he still feels like a failure because they lost. They ultimately lost the war. All they did was survive. And on the boat, they saved all these men, but they lost their friend, the boy who helps them on their boat. And then Tom Hardy achieves this amazing aeronautic feat of shooting down 5 or 6 planes. But then he's captured and he has to burn his plane at the end. And it's just this... It's just such a powerful expression of that, like, that very strong but still dark sense of life. And I really liked it. And I'm wondering maybe, Daniel, if that just didn't resonate for you. Like, because I feel like you're probably a brighter sense of life than I am. Anyway.
Say balls.
Balls.
it certainly didn't resonate with me on an emotional level. The part that did, obviously, was when the ships arrived. But the sort of negativity and the sort of, you know, the downtroddenness of each storyline certainly didn't at all. So there is that. But other Nolan movies have resonated with me that had a bit of that. So like Interstellar, for instance, which I think is still a highly, highly underrated movie, did sort of hit in the emotional sense of life area of my being. So it's interesting. Maybe I have to further think about why this movie didn't quite do it for me. I will say that I think this movie is still like an 8.5, and it's probably still the best movie I've seen this year, even though it doesn't have a full plot.
It'd be interesting to compare it to Wonder Woman and see which is better, but it's definitely up there. I mean, it's definitely probably in the lead for the Romantic Manifestation Award, I would say.
Just in terms, like, Wonder Woman was awesome, and I had a great experience with Wonder Woman, but in terms of construction, it's just hard. Like, you cannot say enough about the epic scope of this movie.
Yes.
With the practical effects, and the air, and the sea, and the land, and it's just an unbelievable scale in modern times to do a movie like this, and do it this well. Yes. While still having flaws, but...
Yes, and as I said, you know, we're going to be talking about this movie more in depth, so if you enjoyed this conversation, you know, look forward to this episode eventually of the Nolan Notes on Dunkirk.
But everything, also, if you have to have alliteration with you.
I even did that unintentionally. Oh, the Nolan Notes? Yeah, come on, yeah. That's a really cool fucking name, the Nolan Notes.
The Snyder series, the Nolan Notes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Rodriguez Repartee? Like,
the Whedon write-up.
Oh God, that, I don't know if we want to talk about Whedon that in depth. It would just like be slowly getting angrier as his career goes on.
The last show is just us screaming for an hour and a half.
Yeah. When we get to Avengers Age of Ultron, it's, what is this movie? It's so bad. No, and all if right. you did, if you enjoyed, you know, if you enjoyed our conversation that we just had, check out the Snyder series. I think you'll really enjoy it. But for now, we have to talk about not what's already out, but we need to talk about what's about to come out.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
The Star is an animated movie about animals in the first Christmas. The first Christmas literally being the birth of Christ. And it follows like the camels who are with the three wise men, and it follows the main character is an ass. So I personally never wanted to see the story of the first Christmas from the perspective of an ass, but I guess, you know, that's where our culture's at, so it's appropriate. I'm going to do something interesting for the first two trailers in this trailer takedown, and I am not going to allow anyone to hug either of these first two trailers. Instead, I'm going to ask you guys questions that I want you to answer. So it is very obvious to me that this is sort of based on the Toy Story model. And what I mean by that is we've been getting a lot of movies about, like, well, what happens when humans aren't around? What's the real story? And this is now, you know, what's the real story of Christmas when we weren't focused on Jesus with the animals? So what I want to ask you is, can you guys come up with any other premises of movies like what happens when humans aren't around?
Yeah, I'd like to see a story of the JFK assassination with squirrels on the grassy knoll.
This is my point. You could pitch that, and that would get made in today's day and age.
I want Patton, but it's about his dog. And how he's cowardly and, like, always is running away from things.
This is what I'm saying.
And you just hear Patton ranting in the background.
These are better ideas than this movie.
Yes, Holocaust, more like Hilaricost in Hitler's Schnauzer.
Oh my God. I don't, obviously, really don't like the Bible because it is associated with a religion that I hate. But, and not only that, but it's the New Testament is the lamest piece of mythology there is. Like, compare it to the ancient Greek mythology, and Jesus Christ, like, you chose this religion when there's this totally badass one you could be ascribed to where you worship the thunder god Jesus. But anyway,
What if they did a Comic-Con movie?
I was still pissed at how this trivializes Christmas.
Yes.
What if they did a Comic-Con movie where all the merch came to life at the end of each day?
That's a good idea. That idea is better than this. That's just you're just describing a remake of Toy Story.
That's what they all are. That's my point. That's what I said at the top.
Rob Schneider is the stapler.
Yes. And it turns out that Jesus would never have been born if it weren't just for this lowly ass. That's totally going to be the end result of this movie. I guarantee you. Oh, only I'm not going to see the movie. So
100%. You know plenty of people will see this movie. Like, people have been shocked this week that the Emoji movie has been making money. Look, here's the deal, ladies and gentlemen. If you can get funding, Midsiders out there, for an animated movie, let's make it, because we will all make lots of money, because there are irresponsible, lazy parents who are just looking for a way to entertain their kids for 2 to 3 hours. So if you get an animated movie with decent marketing, it will make decent money no matter what.
Telling you, Hitler Schnauzer could win Sundance.
Hitler Schnauzer. You even made it a Schnauzer.
Thank you.
That's what they named the rifles after, right?
Oh, I have no idea.
Second trailer.
Brad Status is the latest offering from Amazon Studios, and it's also starring another comedic actor in a dramatic role. This is Ben Stiller, and he's having a midlife crisis because all his friends are successful or retired or some other adjective, and his son is going to college, and it's all about him grappling with sort of this event. This is naturalistic schlock. After we saw the trailer for The Big Sick, which we all hugged, I believed, and that turned out to just be like the epitome of naturalism, I'm telling you guys this, this is the same thing. This is naturalism. I'm not even like letting anyone even try to hug this. So what I want to ask you is, what is Brad's status?
I don't know, awkward. I mean, this is Ben Stiller quintessentially being awkward, but now he's being awkward as a dad, and I don't care.
Awkward.
If I hadn't known this was from the people who made The Big Sick, I also would have tackled this movie because I feel like I've seen Ben Stiller do everything Ben Stiller can do, and it's not great. So I'm a bit over it. The kid looks kind of funny in this show, but that's it. Pass.
James, what is Brad's status?
Purposeless.
I think that is...
Even if he gets over this, you know, insecurity of his, I'm still not going to care. I'll just say, yep, and then I'll turn it off.
I think that's a great way of putting it, because we started this with talking about the definition of plot, which is a purposeful progression of logically connected events, and now we see a movie that is purposeless, and it's because the main character has no efficacy. I think you've nailed it.
Third trailer.
Marjorie Prime is the story of an old woman who is having trouble letting go of her husband, and she uses a computer program, and it's not clear in the trailer whether he's like a robot AI or it's just a program and she manifests him visually. So I would be interested in the movie just to sort of see that from a logistical standpoint. But she manifests a younger version of him to help her cope with whatever is going on in her reality. Interesting thing from the trailer is I was thinking it was playing like a Black Mirror episode, and then one of the critics actually said this is like the best written Black Mirror episode ever. I don't know about that. It seemed to be more towards San Junipero from the tone and the stylizing, so I don't know if I would agree with that assessment. Obviously, I haven't seen it. But the thing I really want to talk about with this trailer is, and this is going to be the reason that I'm hugging this, is just for this one thing, even though I'm sort of unsure about the movie itself. But I think we need to give more respect to Jon Hamm. And what I mean by that is we need to look at Jon Hamm's career and the type of projects he's worked on and who he's worked with. First of all, he was in Mad Men with Matthew Weiner, who 100% is an artist and had his vision and executed it. Then he's worked with Zack Snyder on Sucker Punch. He's worked with Edgar Wright on Baby Driver. He worked with Charlie, I believe his last name, Booker on, he did Black Mirror, literally. So if you look at the roles John Hamm has chosen, he clearly has a good sense of art. And he really admires artists with very defined vision. And I would even argue we need to look and see if John Hamm is a romanticist at heart. And not only that, he is tremendously talented. And we're talking about an era where we're attacking masculinity. Is there anyone who's more perfectly suited to play healthy, idealized masculinity than John Hamm?
Mm.
And that's what I took away from this trailer. I was like, I've really been sleeping on John Hamm. I really have. So because, simply because of
the dream of tens of thousands of women.
Yes. Yes. I'm hugging it just for that reason.
You're hugging Hamm. Got it.
Yes.
Are you saying we should do a series on John Hamm movies called The Hamm Hangouts?
If we were going to do it simply on actors, yes, I would call it The Hamm Hangouts.
Mm-hmm. Interesting premise, and I think these premises are going to get more interesting as things in life sort of reflect what the ethical point of this movie is. So, like, there was a story this week that I almost sent over that I decided not to because it was a little on the nose for Witness the Farce, but it's like the there's a company that has opened a brothel for sex robots, and it's like wildly fucking successful. So they're now looking at branching it out all across the world because you can't outlaw prostitution with a not person, right?
Yeah, so a story popped up in my news feed about that as well, that Japanese men, and this sort of builds on the one we talked about, Japanese kids not having sex. Japanese men are now preferring to have sex in relationships with these sex robots rather than be connected with their wife and family.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's sort of all related. You know, there's sort of the emotional side of this with Marjorie Prime is an interesting ethical, situation. And how far, and that's what the children, I think, are dealing with in this trailer is like, you know, mom likes the AI more than she likes us. And, you know, is she being too disconnected from reality? Is it a dementia thing? Mm. I think it has some interesting questions that it brings up. At the same time, I just will not be able to watch this. Not because I think it'll be a bad movie. It will just make me unbearably sad to watch this movie. So I can't do it, and for that reason I'm tackling it, but I think everyone else should see it if you could deal with it.
Tackle.
James.
This movie looks really good. I didn't notice a single firearm in the whole movie, though, so I probably won't end up seeing it. I saw this not so much as the talk about technology displacing our natural and healthy desires, but more just someone dealing with loss, using this new technology to deal with loss and how that may separate you from the reality of the fact that you don't have your man anymore.
I'm going to hit you with something, James, that you might not like, but false dichotomy, bro. And that's also the first time bro has ever been said with false dichotomy.
I was actually about to circle back to that and how if the technology gives you this way of not having to deal with your loss, you maybe start entering this sort of false realm where your husband's still alive and you start to retreat away from the reality that does exist, which is the rest of your family that is still alive. So that's a very disturbing theme.
So is that a tackle from you? You said because no firearms.
It's a hug, but right. It's the sort of the same as Daniel. This just isn't my kind of movie. I don't enjoy stuff like this.
Yeah, I think after I watch it, I'll have the same reaction you guys are saying, and I'll say it was very well made. But like, I have a hard time often watching movies because it's like if I can watch things that like inspire me, or I can watch this, like why would I engage in this? So yeah, I think there's an interesting cultural discussion about why we make movies that are ultimately sad.
And what I find is most of our good films in general have this highly negatory sense of every single good show we're coming out with now has the same sense of life classification by my scheme. And it's a very negative sense of life. They're all good, but can we get our talented people to write some fucking inspiring stories for a change? But that's just what we got. I think that's what our culture is going to have to put out for now.
David Goyer. Anyway.
David Goyer. Can we all just scream at the top of our lungs, tackle, for the next one, and then just move on to the next segment?
Yeah.
Well, we can after I say a couple of things about it. But before we move on, I just want to say, I think I want to release t-shirts that say false dichotomy, bro. I think that captures the mid-side so perfectly.
Yeah, that's good.
I like it.
I dig.
Final trailer.
Suburbicon is George Clooney's next directorial effort, and it's written by the Coen brothers. There were two things I will say about this before we all yell tackle. I do appreciate that he's trying to stylize it, so I will say that. And, you know, the Coen brothers are unique, and they actually have their own vision, so I think we at least need to respect them for that. But at the same time, this story has been done a million times about how the suburbs are subversively evil, and there's this underlying dark belly of American life. So this is trite, it's didactic, it's been done a billion fucking times before. Tackle.
Matt Damon.
There's that problem as well.
Tackle.
Matt Damon.
Tackle.
Tackle.
All right, I think that sums up Trailer Takedown for this week. So let's move on to the conclusion of the episode where we can laugh a little bit more at the ridiculousness of the society. It's time for another round of Woker Joke.
Everyone, welcome to the best game show in America. It's time for Woke or Joke, the game where you have to decide if these news headlines are real or satire, i.e. woke or joke. Basically, I will read three headlines, and Justin and James will have to determine if one of them is satire or if none of them are satire. That is an option. And you get a point if you get it right, and if none of you get it right, I get a point.
And remember I made the rule that if people submitted headlines that fooled us, they'd win some sort of prize?
Indeed.
Is that in the running this week?
No brave souls have done that, which is okay. It's difficult. I got it. And they're all busy, productive people making money to give to us on patreon.com/themidside.
Yeah, we still love you, Midsiders, but like, oh, you can become a part of this game and a part of Midside mythology. Take advantage of that opportunity.
Not a problem. That's all right. So here we go. Round one is God stuff. Gentlemen, are you ready to play Woker Joke?
Ready.
I guess. Right. I mean, kind of scared.
Headline number one. Vatican outlaws gluten-free bread for Holy Communion. Once again, Vatican outlaws gluten-free bread for Holy Communion. Headline number two. Feminist dismisses Bible as God-splaining. One more time. Feminist dismisses Bible as God-splaining. And headline number three, which has nothing to do with God stuff, but is the only place I could fit it into the show. Well, it kind of does, I guess. Actually, it does. Never mind. I'm a genius. Ready? Headline number three. Drag queen says Britain's queer Muslim community is flourishing. One more time. Drag queen says Britain's queer Muslim community is flourishing. Justin, woke or joke?
Fuck. You are getting better at this.
Exactly.
So I was like, the first two, I was like, okay, those are legit. So I was like, this third one's going to be ridiculous. But the third one is the most woke of all. That is real.
Exactly.
That has to be real. I mean, there's no other way. No one's going to come up with that. It's too hyper-specific. Now, that means we have to tease out the other two. Here's the thing with the first one. That seems at first blush to be a joke, but the Pope is super social justice-y right now. So you can see him doing the whole gluten thing. Especially with his, like, his obsession with pseudoscience. Wait, I mean, I guess that's satire on my part saying that, but that wasn't intended. And then the second one. I want that to be satire so badly, because that is fucking brilliant satire. Dismissing the Bible as God-splaining. But it seems like they would do that. It does. So here's what I'm going to do. I haven't really heard splaining be transferred to anywhere else except I Love Lucy. It's only been mansplaining so far. So I'm going to say number two is the satirical article. This may just be emotional well-wishing on my part.
All right. James, woke or joke?
So I agree with all of Justin's analysis, but I'll add this. The Vatican gluten thing, that's the Vatican banning gluten-free wafers, right?
Vatican outlaws gluten-free bread for Holy Communion.
Oh, I misunderstood it. Fuck.
Yeah. So that, well, I think you're still right, though. This makes you more right, because I think I could totally see some kind of really hyper-specific rule that makes them ban it. I think if they were going to do a joke on this, they would explain how the Vatican is now making their wafers gluten-free in order to, you know, promote a just society or something. That's what the fucking our current Pope would fucking say right now.
Our Pope. We are members of the world community,
I guess. And we're both
I was raised Catholic.
I was too, so yeah, I guess he's our Pope. Anyway,
that's our Pope.
The feminist god-splaining, that's satire. It's number two. I'm with Justin.
Gentlemen, apparently you are also getting better at the game, because that is the joke article, and it is excellent satire from the Babylon Bee, once again.
Good, that's good. There's some good satire out there. Did you see the article I posted, The Onion, about Six Flags' newest roller coaster? It's about your relationship with Deborah. If you get a chance, look at my Facebook. That's probably the greatest piece The Onion's ever written. Very good.
Yes. All right, gentlemen, round two of Woke or Joke. This is politics stuff. And here we go. Headline number one. Rihanna met Emmanuel Macron, and her handshake was way better than Trump's. One more time. Rihanna met Emmanuel Macron, and her handshake was way better than Trump's. Headline number two. Rick Perry got duped by a Russian prank call about pig poop. Headline number two again. Rick Perry got duped by a Russian prank call about pig poop. And headline number three. Girl Scouts seek restraining order against Donald Trump. Headline number three. Girl Scouts seek restraining order against Donald Trump. James, woke or joke?
Oh my god, this is so hard. Okay. Macron handshake. So Rihanna shook Macron's hand, and it was better than Donald Trump's handshake. That can't be comedy, because that's not even that funny. That just sounds like something stupid they would write. So I think that's woke. Rick Perry pig poop? What? Rick Perry gets fooled by a Russian prankster talking about pig poop. That's not very funny satire either. So now number three sounds like it would absolutely happen. I'm just imagining some sort of local community of moms, like, you know, who effectively run the Girl Scout, you know, camp for the girls. It's one of those deals where it's like, oh, we can't let our kids be independent for even a moment of their day. So, like, we're going to have this group activity where they're supervised also. And we're also going to turn it into, you know, we're also going to turn it political. We're going to make it sound like, you know, Donald Trump is going to personally come in and fondle these Girl Scouts. That sounds like something they would absolutely do, but it's the only possible candidate for a joke, so, like, because everything else just isn't that funny as a joke. So I'm going with number three as the joke. Oh, wait, right. It's possible that they're all real, right?
That is correct.
Oh, they're all real. That's
okay.
What I'm going with.
Is that
all
your final
woke
answer,
woke
James?
Across the board. What's that?
Is that your final answer?
That is my final answer.
Okay. Justin, woke or joke?
Interesting. I don't think they're all real. So this is what I'm going to say. I can prove the first one is real 100% in a way that you guys haven't realized. Luc Besson is from France. So I know for a fact that Rihanna was in France to be at the premiere of Valerian, which she was in. And I'm willing to bet that's when she shook the macaroon's hand. And we also know the media is obsessed with Donald Trump's hand and handshake for some reason. It's ridiculous. Like, they, like, this is their code word for, like, his dick. It's, like, fucking ridiculous. They've just, they just tried to say Rihanna has a bigger dick than Donald Trump, by the way, which that says number of things about our culture. The fact that we would want Rihanna to have a bigger dick than Donald Trump. I don't even, like, okay. The third one, I think that's true. That one could be satire, but I think it's true because of the way, you know, it said Donald Trump's taking away women's rights and he wants to rape women and that he's a rapist, just because people didn't understand that he was saying they would let you grab them by the pussy, not that he's actually ever done that. Just
we're
the,
still
the simple,
talking about that.
It's just fucking, absurd. Like, it's absurd that, because this is what happens when you repeat this shit, then the Girl Scouts put a restraining order against our goddamn president. And then the second one, I actually think the second one's a joke for two reasons. Well, no, three reasons. One, it's hyper-specific in a ridiculous way. And it's in that hyper-specificity sounds like the Black Mirror episode where the guy fucked a pig. The British guy, the British prime minister had to fuck a pig. Also, this is number two, so I think Daniel's fucking with us by having the joke be number two twice in a row. And then... number three, I am actually going to make a prediction that not only is this a joke, but this is an Onion headline. Because here's the thing. How would you really know Rick Perry got pranked about this? So number two is a joke, and it's an Onion headline.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, one of them is a joke. So James is automatically out this round. But in fact, it is number three! The Girl Scouts obtained restraining order against Trump is a New Yorker... Borowitz Report headline, and Rick Perry getting duped by a Russian prank call about pig poop is true. He it was a phone call related to the Paris climate deal and other things, I think, and it was from like a Russian, I don't know, like prankster TV show or something. So that's a Vice article, so almost a joke, but not quite.
And I was right, that's when she shook the macaroon's hand, right?
That is true. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
See? Wow.
So,
I'm smart.
I got
over here.
A point. So we are all tied after two rounds.
Oh, that's right, Daniel got a point. Damn it.
Round three, SJW stuff. All right.
Is that like butt
here
stuff?
Here we go. It is like butt stuff.
Anything with stuff is now...
Right. Well, I just figured we're gonna fuck a lot in this round and then end up with shit all over ourselves. So it sounded like butt stuff.
Wow,
you
thank you,
hold
Justin.
That thought.
Thank
okay.
you so much.
Headline
thank you for saying that.
Number one, woker joke. Headline number one: I deposited my entire savings into a black bank, and you should too. Again, I deposited my entire savings into a black bank, and you should too. Headline number two, gay bars can be mind-bogglingly racist. Headline number two, gay bars can be mind-bogglingly racist. And headline number three, millennials are making pooping cool again. One last time, millennials are making pooping cool again.
Oh man, Daniel's gonna win this.
Justin... woke or joke?
I'm going to say something that's going to shock you right off the bat. These are all true. All three of these are true. Without a doubt, all three of these are true. The first one is vintage virtue signaling. I mean, you know who would love this is Gavin Newsom. Because, I mean, we're using black banks and supporting them so they're not going to check cashing places, which are taking advantage of minorities at a higher rate, apparently. This is what Gavin Newsom says, right, Daniel?
That's right.
Right. The second one, that is very clearly SJW, because we've seen and we've tracked this ever since Midsider Williams sent us the article about how gay white men no longer have their status as victims anymore. Now they have privilege. So we've been seeing this coming for a while. And the third one, I mean, that's BuzzFeed culture right there. So all of these have to be true. I don't even, like, honestly, I don't even want to waste energy trying to figure out if one of them's fake, because even if they aren't true yet, they will be true soon.
All right. James, woke or joke?
My reasoning is exactly the same as Justin's, only Justin included a lot of things I didn't think of, and so that just strengthens my original opinion. These are all woke. That is what I'm going with.
Gentlemen, we have a tie because these are, in fact, all woke.
Yes.
A lot of our articles this week came from Vice.com. Vice.com, the place to get your crappy news.
Literally, when you talk about millennials and pooping.
That's right. So we have to use the tiebreaker, which is my favorite. So the way the tiebreaker works now is that I just go to Justin, and Justin first gets to decide if he wants to play or punt.
Defer.
And
I'm just kidding. I want to make that joke every time, by the way.
I know you are. And then that person, whether it be Justin or James, just has to tell me if this article is woke or joke. So, Justin, here is the headline that you get to decide if you want to punt on or play. Are goats taking jobs from union workers? One more time. Are goats taking jobs from union workers?
This is, in Justin. Fact, a woke article that is all about Tom Brady taking jobs from Jimmy Garoppolo. So this is woke.
So you're playing?
Yeah, I'm saying it's woke.
It is woke. Congratulations, you have won Woke or Joke. It has nothing to do with Tom Brady and everything to do with a herd of goats mowing the lawn at a school campus faster and like 10,000 times cheaper than the union lawnmowers. So,
I mean, that sounds equivalent to Tom Brady taking Jimmy Garoppolo's jobs. I mean, he does it better and faster than Jimmy Garoppolo would do it. I mean, James, would you have said that's woke or joke?
Oh, I don't know. I was too busy laughing at the premise, or just the intersectionality of it. Just the pure arbitrary interrelation of like all different things leftist.
So
I don't know. I don't know what I would have said.
Justin,
I'm still laughing at it.
Can tell the difference between woke or joke, and until next time, stay woke or not.
All right, gentlemen, let's wrap up this episode. What did we learn this trip? Daniel?
I learned that we are basically reverse intervening in Hillary Clinton's life. We're basically shoving liquor down her throat while she's screaming, I might be an alcoholic, which is hilarious.
It's true. James?
I learned that not all science, there's at least one person in media who's capable of writing about a science article, or at least capable of attempting to write objectively about scientific research. I honestly have never seen that before. But then again, maybe I'm just not a neuroscientist, and as a result, couldn't find all of the gaping, terrible flaws. But that's what I learned, is that maybe.
Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned more information that I hadn't concretized and said explicitly before about why I prefer and think Snyder is a better filmmaker than Nolan. That's always been a question in my mind, because I think that's a very difficult argument to make culturally, because I don't think a lot of people would accept that. But I think that I'm beginning to arm myself better in that argument.
Well, ladies and gentlemen of the Midside, if you learned something, tell us about it on the social medias. We have all of them. We have Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat.
Facebook.
Everywhere we have the social medias, that's at the Midside.
Everywhere.
Justin will personally respond to you, because that's what he does all day, every day, even at
personally.
So it's pretty that's true. Right.
And it'll be a good time. You'll get a fun response from Justin, and you can tell him to fuck off. You can tell him you love him. You can tell him balls. Whatever it is, he will love it. If you don't have time to do that,
well, disclaimer: I don't love balls.
Oh, you just love shouting balls. So I
yes.
Figured, yeah. But if you don't have time to do that, that's perfectly fine. What you should make time to do is to tell a friend about the podcast. Number one way our podcast grows is through word of mouth. Not our mouths, but yours. Your mouths opening and the words, listen to Welcome to the Midside, coming out of them to people who have not previously listened to the show.
Well, it starts with our mouths, and then they repeat what we say to them.
It is literally the mechanics of how we grow this shit. So let's do it. I know you can. I know you have some friends, at least some of you do. Some of you, meh. But some of you have friends, and they need to know about the show. So tell
Here's the way you get them. When they say something that could be one thing, but they say them as if they're two opposites, just go false dichotomy, bro. And then when they ask what you're talking about, just say, welcome to the midside. You got them. Got them.
You got them. Got them. They're yours.
You got them.
Got them. And let's not forget to thank Liberty.me, the libertarian folks who syndicate this show through their feed. We appreciate that. And we thank to give thanks for our libertarian audience.
I love libertarians. Just want to put that out there.
That's right. They're delicious on toast with some avocado. And, of course, we have patreon.com/themidside. Patreon is a platform where we post our content, and you can choose to give us sums of money. $1, $0.25, $10 every time we publish content for you. It is not a subscription service, meaning it does not charge you when we do not release content. So if we take a month off and go to fucking Tahiti, I wish
it's a magical place.
Yeah, we don't get any money. So it's all value driven, and it helps us keep the lights on.
Keep the lights on.
Thank you, James. And we love that. We love lights. We love lamp and lights. And
just not the Canadian singer lights. She's kind of weird.
Is that a person? I didn't know that was a person.
Yes, it is.
Well, thanks for joining us. Tell a friend, and until next time, we love you dearly.
This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin M. Wozniewski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day!
Have a day.
I just barely heard that.